The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
It is the Anton Savage Show. It is News Talk. We're with you between now and 12 o'clock. I'm joined in studio by John Moran, Mayor of Limerick, who is already campaigning to get us to move the show down to Limerick on a temporary basis. John, do we do one or two? He says he'll find us a decent venue to do the programme from. John Moran is with us. Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at Independent Newspapers, is with us, as is Ursula Savage, political commentator. Did you have any challenge in getting through the city this morning, by the way?
I was grand. No, I was lucky enough to come down. I suppose we came through the Port Tunnel and then parked over the convention centre and taxied across. So we kind of bypassed all the closures and everything. So it worked out quite well.
Were you amazed at the amount of fit people that we have in Ireland? I have never seen that many skinny people in one place in my life.
It's incredible. And seeing everybody getting ready when the taxi was coming across. And there's a great atmosphere comes with it though, isn't there? And everybody's buzzing and everybody's excited. And for a millisecond you go, wouldn't it be great to be involved? And then you think about it, you think, no, well, go sit and talk about the papers.
Yes, that early setup piece where you walk to the start line looks like fun. Everything after that just looks like an awful lot of pain.
It does. And even the way people talk about it and they're finished, they say it was a nightmare, it was awful, I can't wait to do it again. And you're just like, what is going on, you know? But
ever
it's very impressive.
Kevin, would you do it?
Well, would you believe, Anton, I'm in a WhatsApp group called Cool Runnings B Team, and it started out as kind of a few lads out where I live, and we'd go for like a 5k jog in the evening. Now they're all doing the marathon and I'm sitting in here with you. And I have committed to buying them a round of pints at the end. So it's it's such a commitment. I don't know how anybody, unless you're at a certain stage in life. But I did hear an interesting stat. I'm 39. I heard an interesting stat that a friend told me last night. Apparently, if you go through it, you'll probably find out that most of the people doing it have a 9 in their age. So 29, 39, 59, that apparently when you're on the cusp of crossing into a new age bracket, you get this urge to...
That's so you get a sort of a roundy birthday crisis and you want to squeeze it in before you cross that threshold.
Yeah.
Anything you want to comment in relation to that, John? Are you happy enough to let us...
I'm very worried about this 9 thing, since 59 is next year and I'm going to have to be taking time out of my mayoral duties to learn to practice. But I'll be doing the Limerick Marathon though. I won't be doing the Dublin one first.
Have you ever done one?
I did a 10k during the election campaign to prove that I was over cancer and fit to be mayor. So I was delighted to be able to finish that.
How much training did you have to do the 10K?
Damon goes out all the time about me because he trains all the time and I tend not to. And he puts it down to, I have this thing called hemochromatosis, which is excess iron in the blood. And he's kind of reckoned that my lack of training for these things is down to this unfair advantage I have.
Well, you should do a marathon the same way. Yeah, there's not that big a gap between 10K and 20K.
Yeah, sure.
First man out. I should remind everybody, John Moran, Mayor of Limerick, is with us, as is Ursula Savage, political commentator, and Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at Media House. And from Kevin's perspective, things are getting busy politically, it looks like. We may not have an official date on an election. We do have a lot of electioneering and a lot of rumours of coalitions starting to get tense. Sunday Times leading with coalition split on housing as election looms.
Yeah, it's like the most wonderful time of the year of the political cycle, because the election is on. There's no doubt about it. It has been on, I think, for some weeks now. But if you look at today's papers, there is no doubt that the parties are now actively canvassing and the conscious uncoupling of the government parties is happening. There's a story in the Sindo where the Greens are hitting out at Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, claiming that they're the only ones who drove any policy or ideology in government. The Sunday Times story is about, we had expected there to be new housing targets, which I always felt was a bit odd to launch new housing targets 3-4 weeks out from an election anyway, because that's a government that won't necessarily be there in a few weeks' time, announcing what it thinks we should be doing in 2030. It seems that Fine Gael and the Greens wanted to go ahead with that anyway, and Micheál Martin and maybe even Housing Minister Dara O'Brien wanted to go ahead with it, according to the story, but Micheál Martin pulled the plug and basically said, no, let's do it in our manifestos. You set out what you want to do. I'll set out what I want to do. I suppose they're going to have these...
That it's a stick to beat themselves with if they get back into government, is that it?
On the grounds that if you commit to something, that there's an issue now for the government, because Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are most likely going to end up back in government together. That's one option facing the electorate. The other option is something radically different. But they don't really want to say that bit out loud, because if you do, then it becomes a kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that it's this thing which Sinn Féin have thrown at the party, the old Civil War parties for years of, oh, FFG, and, you know, they've been in power for 100 years. So they're trying to avoid creating that narrative while knowing that that narrative is there already. So there will be these little skirmishes, there will be these little rows, and you will have the idea that Fine Gael will have to put forward a platform, Fianna Fáil will have to put forward a platform, and at the end of it, if they end up with the numbers, they'll end up putting a programme to government that will really be a soup of the two of them, and they'll get to say, well, we abandoned all those promises because it's a coalition, and here's the ones that we ended up with.
It's an interesting challenge, John, in terms of vote transfers, because we've had situations before where you have an evident very junior partner, whether it was PDs, whether it was Labour, who was able to go out and get red in tooth and claw in their dialogue in the run-up to an election, but where you have pretty much equal partners, you can't fall out too far, presumably.
No. And I think, look, we saw it in the local elections that there was a very strong transferability between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and going backwards and forwards in both directions, frankly. And I think that's the biggest strength that they have going into this election. I mean, I think there was some talk, and it's picked up in the newspapers today, about, well, maybe, you know, Sinn Féin might go in with, they won't, I don't think it's Fine Gael in any scenario, but there are some parts of Fianna Fáil would have said that was possible, especially a couple of months ago. You know, is that
although
the alternative?
Although Micheál Martin continues to rule
out in the papers. I said some parts of Fianna Fáil would have counted as that. I think others are as opposed to it as Fine Gael. But I think that is your kind of alternative, and I suppose choices are good for the public in some ways, and that's why, I mean, and this housing target one is interesting because, of course, many people have been saying that that was the right housing target for years, right? And so in some ways, having the right numbers helps, I suppose, the public going into an election to assess policies.
It doesn't necessarily help you deliver those numbers, though, does it? You want to be very careful saying we're going to increase the housing targets when you have proven, until fairly recently, an incapacity to deliver the targets you already set.
No, but this was always the big problem with Housing for All, right? I mean, you know, and it's not a case of I told you so. I mean, there were a number of people that were saying that the 30,000 target, which I think we all admit now or agree now, was set by a system analysis that says this is the most we can actually achieve, right? And therefore, there was a desire not to miss the targets. Whereas had there been a more realistic number at the time, and, you know, I mean, we were saying we thought it was 45, 50,000 with the unmet demand. No one would have believed that they could have delivered 50,000 homes the first year. But it would have meant that the system would have worked towards a much higher target by about now. And therefore, the credibility of delivery would have been established. I mean, you'd have gone 30, 35, 30, but then you would have been able to scale up. We're down in a situation in Limerick, for example, we've only got 4,000 planning permissions in the system. So that's only a year's worth of supply. And we know how long it takes to get planning permission. And that's because we can't zone enough land, because these national level targets get spread out across the whole country. And so you only get targets, half of the...
In your view, the targets then do have a direct impact on how the system operates.
Impact on the system, because...
So they're more than an aspiration?
No, absolutely. Because when you set the target of growth at 30,000, let's say, you can only then in the development plans collectively across the country aim for that. You can't aim for 100,000. So in effect, you reduce the level of ambition right across the whole country below its natural rate. Whereas if they had said to Limerick, oh, well, look, you need to have 4,000 homes, not 2,000 homes a year, which is closer to the number I would believe, we could have had for the last 3 or 4 years all the planning permissions in place to actually start delivering that now.
Can I ask John about the politics of that, though? Because Simon Harris said at Béal na Bláth back in August that we'd hit 40,000 houses this year, new homes this year. I think for the first three quarters of the year, we're at about 22,000. So we're not going to hit that at all. And I actually recorded a podcast with him earlier in the week where I put that to him. And he's like, oh, well, that's what the Department of Housing told me was the figure. But he's now going to face the thing where he stood up in the summer and said 40,000. They're not going to make it. They'll probably make 33, 35 on a good day by the end of the year if there's an acceleration in the last couple of months. So politically, he's now going to get beaten over the head for saying 40,000 when we know that's just not actually plausible.
Yeah, but what I'm asked for, and I'm again asking for, was somewhat different, right? It was an acknowledgement that the state needed, let's say 60,000 or 50,000 homes done 3 years ago, and that it would be scaling up to deliver that at the earliest possible opportunity, which wasn't going to be the following year or the year after, because you need to get the planning permissions, you need to get the, frankly, enough builders in Ireland to be able to do that. But remember, Ireland delivered 80,000 homes, so physically was able to deliver 80,000 homes back in the last crisis. I've always felt that politically, and you'll remember this, just about young enough to, or old enough to remember, this was like the last crisis where we spent a couple of months, if not years, going into the bailout, underestimating the amount of capital the banks needed. And because we were scaling the amount of capital and trying to back justify it based on how much money we thought we had. Okay. Instead, the sea change came in 2011 when we acknowledged the right number for the capital of the banks. Now, it cost us getting into a bailout to be able to fulfill it. But from that moment on, I mean, literally from that March 2011, certainly in the first quarter, government bond rates started to reduce. The whole system turned around because of one single point. We had our credible.
Now, are the two comparable, John? Because the difference, of course, with the banking issue is that there is an issue of market confidence and we are exposed to international factors that I wouldn't have thought are the same.
It's
when it comes
the same
to
market issue. So let me take you through this, right? So if you tell me, as was happened when Housing for All, that we are going for a target that's too low compared to what everybody thinks the demand is, the market participants looking at Ireland are saying, bingo, big opportunity here. House prices are going to keep going up. Rents are going to keep going up. And so we will overpay in year one for housing that we know will be worth way more money in year 10. Right? If you had said the right number, what would have happened is that actually all of those market participants, the so-called funds, the private investors, would have said, well, hold on a second, rents are going to go down in Ireland in year 4, 5, 6. So I will pay less in 2021 for a home than I did in scenario one. So actually house prices would have gone down if Housing for All had been successful on its target the following day.
Well, I should remind people, by the way, that John, of course, was in the Secretary General of the Department of Finance from
12 to 14.
12 to 14. So that period, obviously, you would have been at the forefront of what you are discussing. And it's interesting, the period just after that, 2017, is referred to in some detail in Owen Murphy's excerpted piece in the Sunday Independent. Him then, Housing Minister at that period, and has written a book about that experience and his experience in government. We will come to that in a second. Before that, Ursula, can I ask one question out of this, which is, if you look at the polling, again, there's Red Sea polling in the Business Post, which we will come to. Despite the fact that the housing crisis continues unabated, whether we discuss the targets that should be set and the targets that have or haven't been achieved, it doesn't seem to have converted or to convert into political impact. It isn't costing either of the main government parties votes, according to the polls.
No, and I find that very bizarre. I find that very strange that no matter what happens with what people are talking about as the biggest crisis facing the electorate in the South at the moment, it doesn't seem to actually have an impact on the support for the two major parties. And, I mean, the latest figures came out there lately for homelessness, can't just happen to hand there, but
we have a record, 15,400, I think.
Yeah, between 15,000
and 14,760 was the figure this week.
And over 4,000 of those children as well. But even when those figures come out, it doesn't seem to have this impact, and I find it very strange. I also find it very strange that at this stage, when those governments have been in, or when those parties have been in government for such a long time, that now they're coming up with solutions and saying we'll change this and we'll change that, and they have all these solutions now. Where were those solutions, and really, what are they doing now that's any different to what has come before?
A text saying, show me exactly where the workers are to build the 80,000 homes. I think we're looking at, I think 60,000 was the proposal. Martin said, Micheál Martin saying, quoted in the Times, saying he wanted to accelerate delivery to 60,000 a year. So the text saying, show me where the workers are to build the 80,000 homes. We don't need planning reforms during the Celtic Tiger to build, or we didn't need them to build 80,000 houses a year. The issue is we don't have workers. Presumably this is one of those that's multifactorial, but one of the factors is we don't have enough people to currently build.
Yeah, but compared to 10 years ago, we have totally different ways of constructing apartments now. We can actually buy basically Lego sets and construct them if we wanted, which means that a lot of workers that you need to actually have an apartment block can, for at least the short term, be outsourced to another country and we just import them and actually build up the capacity. And this is what I mean by the difference between pretending that you can have it the first year after the election and just actually having a credible plan to the right target.
I mentioned that the excerpts from Owen Murphy's book, this is entitled Running From Office because of the alacrity with which he took to departing his ministerial role. It's inside the Sunday Independent. We'll have a look at some of that after this break. It is News Talk. It's the Anton Savage Show. We're with you through until 12 o'clock. I'm joined by John Moran, formerly Secretary General of the Department of Finance, now Mayor of Limerick, Kevin Doyle, who's Group Head of News at Independent Newspapers, and Ursula Savage, political commentator. And inside one of Kevin Doyle's newspapers, that being the Sunday Independent, is a big two-page spread, The Minister Who Ran From Office. This is Owen Murphy, to some extent the power behind, or at least beside the throne in Leo Varadkar's government, talking about the ascension of Leo Varadkar to being Taoiseach and his role in that, and his ascension to cabinet, and his fairly rapid desire to want to get out of it. Kevin, your take on what this has revealed and your take on the book.
I have to say it's a pretty extraordinary series of extracts from the book, because political memoirs are often reflective and they're talking about kind of what people thought about what was happening in front of them. But actually, this is all Owen Murphy talking about what was going on in his own head throughout all this period. So we get some insights into things like Leo Varadkar arriving down at his house and they get a takeaway and beers and they have lollipop sticks with TD's names on them as they try to decide what Leo Varadkar's first cabinet as Taoiseach would be. So you kind of get those quirky things of really, is that how the future of the country is being decided on lollipop sticks, which is kind of entertaining. But actually, for the most part, I actually think it's kind of sad. You kind of get an insight into a guy who seems to have had quite a lot of demons while he was in government. I was political editor of the Indo at the time, so I would have known Owen very well. And certainly you would see when people were struggling and, you know, not in a good mood and all the rest of it. But I mean, it gets to the point where he's going around getting different pills from doctors because he's not able to sleep at night with the pressure around being the Minister for Housing.
Kevin, it's worth saying he's getting different pills and doctors because by his own admission or by his own statement in the piece, one doctor would not prescribe him enough. So he is deliberately increasing his access to medication to try to get sleep.
Yeah, he's self-medicating, basically. Another point, he goes to London with some friends for a night out. And when they all go to bed, he just starts running through the streets of London in the rain aimlessly in his own head. And basically, it all kind of... He starts out going, I never wanted to be this, but then I got into politics and I did want it and I became hugely ambitious and I wanted to be the biggest and the best and almost this kind of monster of himself. And then it ends really with him crying in Leo Varadkar's office and saying, I'm not doing that. I can't do this anymore. I don't want to be the minister. And basically he felt as if the system was against him, the media were against him, the public were against him, and that everybody was blaming him for what was happening in housing.
The outset of that, though, and Ursula, I would like your view on this, the level of ambition that is outlined. I mean, if you were of the view that all people got into politics or that many got into politics for altruistic reasons, this might dispel that notion. He says, in that moment, I didn't care what promises had been made. I cared about recognition, about having my own department, my own seat at the cabinet table and everything that came with that. He goes on, he needed to acknowledge, this being Leo Varadkar, what I had done for him and what I could do for him. It wasn't threatening because there was no threat. I wasn't going to fall out with him no matter what his decision, but I definitely didn't want to be made to look like a fool. He goes on, now I was destined for more. I had convinced myself and others had told me. I had read it in the newspapers and seen it on TV. And when he finally gets the appointment to cabinet, he said, just like that, we were back to where things had left off. Only now we were plotting not his leadership campaign, but the new government. Two guys across a table, the country's future is in our hands.
Yeah, there's a lot in that, isn't there? That kind of that grandiose world on your shoulders kind of thing, but he is the one destined for great things. And it's that part of it. And then you go on and you see everything else that came after it. But when I was reading that part, I just thought he really does seem to have believed his own hype and believed everything that was being said to him. And like, you are wonderful, you are wonderful, you are wonderful. And he said, yes, I am. And there's nothing I can't do. And it's that kind of invincibility that he must have felt in that moment, saying, like, of course, I'm going to have a fantastic portfolio and I'm going to snap my fingers and sort out all the country's problems and no problem at all. If you set yourself up to that level of expectation, both not only that's the expectation that people around you have of you, but if you have that level of expectation of yourself, then it is no wonder that what came next, because that is really inevitable. Because if you set yourself up for perfection at every single stage, you're never going to achieve it and you're never going to be satisfied and you're never going to be able to sleep at night. And then with the portfolio that he had in housing and the challenges that were facing him and housing in general at that stage, he came in for such harsh treatment from the public, rightly or wrongly, whatever was going on. Well, I would say in this case wrongly, because he does detail in this extract a lot of the abuse that he faced out in public and people coming up to shake his hand as if they're being friendly and then saying things that you can't say on the radio at this time in the morning to him. And
the one,
saying
the that one
when
that stood out from Ursula was there was a man stopped him with his daughter and then said hello to him, was polite, and then introduced him to his daughter as the man who makes children homeless.
Yeah.
I mean, that's hard to take walking down the street, in fairness.
I mean, imagine going from the heights of the future of the country is in my hands and I'm the puppet master putting together this government and everybody bows to my will, to I am making children homeless and this is what people are saying about me on the street in public. Nobody, I don't think, no matter what level of resilience that you have, would ever be able to face that without having major, major challenges before them. And I think this really details so kind of so personally and so deeply kind of how he had associated all his self-worth as a person with how he managed in his job. And that's something that you see in people with jobs in lots of different fields and lots of different things, but not somebody who's so much in the public eye as what he is. And whenever I read that paragraph about how he was being treated and the way that he felt and all the rest of it, I just thought, who would read that and think, I think a career in politics sounds good to me?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because John Moran, of course, was sitting close to the people who were doing these jobs for a number of years when he was Secretary General at the Department of Finance, and then decided, I wouldn't mind having a go at that myself. Is this representative of political life, or is Owen Murphy an anomaly in this?
No, I don't think he is, actually. I think that there's a lot of learnings we can do here. I mean, I think Ursula just mentioned about it being similar to other careers, right? So whether you're a famous footballer, you drop a ball across, you know, at the wrong time going across in a World Cup rugby game or whatever. You know, I think a lot of people are those people that strive for perfection, right? And politics is in some ways worse, because I think the public expect politicians to be perfect, to always be able to deliver and everything else. And if anything, what I suppose resonates with me is I think it's really good, particularly going into an election, that we have this wake-up call about the vulnerability of politicians in the way that we set up the system. But also what I've picked up in that short extract, which I would say I can have some sympathy with, because, I mean, I'm down in Limerick at the moment. I think I have a whole load of answers. The people of Limerick have voted for it in an election campaign. And it is frustrating to be, as I felt him being in terms of housing, thinking about, these are all the innovative things I want to do. These are the things I want to actually push across the line. And for whatever reason or other, and some of it's inertia, some of it may be fear, the system is constantly stopping him from doing that for a number of years. Nobody outside of the department is aware of the blockages and the rest that he's trying to battle against. But yet he's the one taking the blame from everybody outside, who themselves are going through serious issues in terms of homelessness.
But is that not the case in a senior position in any organisation? If you're a CEO, the fact that you are ostensibly in charge doesn't mean that you can command change. It is about bringing senior management with you. It's about bringing unions with you. It is about very gently turning ocean liners.
But you are the CEO, right? And that's the difference, right? In the private sector, I think a lot of us look at politics through the eyes of a private sector lens, where CEOs do that or don't. Whereas actually the system can often be set up, my own being a perfectly good example of it. I mean, I don't have any responsibility for HR. I have to write papers to prove to the Department of Housing that we have a housing crisis in Limerick. I mean, you know, we know it, the public know it, and they know it. But there is a process that slows everything down. And if you are just anxious, as he was, to just get on with it and solve the problems that, as you said, he knew he could solve. The strange thing about, I suppose, the difference between myself and somebody like Owen in that one, is the other thing about government ministers is they never know when tomorrow comes. I mean, there could be a fall of government in the morning. So they have an intense pressure on them to try and get things done that they want to get done. At least I have 5 years, but I'm still feeling under a lot of pressure to just get answers and to get things moving, because I know how serious the problems are on the ground. And unlike people that are in back rooms, unlike people even in here, as you can see from that extract, he is in the public eye. In fact, he's hiding from the public eye because he's aware that there's a level of criticism coming to him that is exactly the self-criticism that he's probably holding himself up to. And it's not that different from what Keith Woods was saying recently. When you have a bad game as a rugby player, you do not want to go out for a couple of days because everybody feels the same disappointment that you do in spades.
The one thing that I wanted to get a view on that I was intrigued by is when you talk about the objectives that he had and what he was trying to achieve. At this period, we had about 5,000 people who were homeless, something the order of 3,000 children who are homeless. There was about 180 people sleeping rough on the streets of predominantly cities around the country, but small towns to some extent as well. In this excerpt, which runs to, what would you say that is? 4,000 words,
it's
maybe?
5,000 words.
5,000 words. In the 5,000 words, there is only one mention of somebody either homeless or in need of accommodation. One in 5,000 words. And the reason that they are mentioned is because they died on the streets and Owen Murphy felt that he was unfairly blamed for it.
Yeah, no, I suppose we should say, and I haven't read the whole book, so there may well be other parts of that. But yeah, I mean, it there is no doubt, I said it at the start, this is inside his head. This is very much his narrative, his view of how all of this played out. And I suppose he is the title of the book, Running from Office. It really, I feel like he's trying to get across how hard it is to be a politician. People didn't understand really when he stood down all of a sudden. And what one thing that's interesting is he went, obviously Leo Varadkar is working on a book. I gather he has the first draft of a book done, although it won't be out till this time next year. Leo Varadkar, who was convincing him to stay at the time in this extract, has gone and done something very similar by walking away in a very kind of sudden fashion as well a few years later. So it'll be interesting to see, I suppose, what his version of that is.
We talked then about the political impact of all this, because, of course, the housing numbers, if you look at the numbers when Owen Murphy was there, we were being told it was a crisis then, and the numbers have nearly tripled since that period across. I don't think that the Rough Sleepers numbers have tripled, but the people on in seeking accommodation have. Political implications of all this, Ursula, we have the Business Post doing a breakdown of where the parties stand. They're claiming it as an exclusive, which I assume it is, given that it's Red Sea working for them. It says Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil on track for an overall majority. The Greens may not even be needed. And Sinn Féin's line, when you look at the graph that is provided, is, I assume from their perspective, fairly horrifying.
Fairly horrifying, very horrifying for Sinn Féin, I would say, at this stage. And it is, I think it's interesting. Funny, when I was reading the poll this morning, I was thinking, this campaign could actually become quite like the campaigns that you see in the north, in that the parties are sitting around a table together in government. They all go out for an election. They all say that party doesn't know what they're doing. But yes, we know that after this election, we'll probably be sitting around the table with them again. Now, in the north, they don't have a choice. They can either do that or have no government at all, which sometimes they like to do. But here, I think that it is it's going to be a very funny dynamic when you're seeing that all kind of signs are pointing towards we're going to see Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael sitting at the government again together. So how are they going to work that? Now, the local government elections at the start of the summer there, we saw that they are very transfer friendly to one another. But now you're going to go into this general election, and it's not just people worrying about their running mates from their own parties. They're also going to be trying to age out these transfer friendly opposing parties as well. So it'll be a very strange dynamic going into that. How do they attack each other without turning each other down? How do they criticise each other's policies without looking like fools whenever they turn around to go into government with them after the election, if that's what they decide to do and if that's the way the electorate decides things? So they'll be confident and pleased with these results, the two main parties there, but at the same time, it is going to make this campaign kind of, you know, the nuance is going to really matter in this one, I think.
And the nuance is going to matter particularly when it comes to independence, because what we've seen is a shift from Sinn Féin. To give you the headline numbers, Fine Gael down 1 on 22, Fianna Fáil up 3 on 21, Sinn Féin down 1 to 17. Now, of course, the Sinn Féin number is significant because at one point they were at 35. So that is a precipitous drop from where they once were. Labour stalled at 4%, Sock Dems in around 5%. Independence at 15. And this is an interesting one, John, because the analysis provided by Richard Caldwell, the MD of Red Sea, is saying that independent vote is very difficult to predict, and very difficult to predict both at local areas and in its total quantum of scale as the campaign begins.
Yeah, and the question for me in the independence is will it in some ways become a coalition around certain ideas so that there'll be similarity, or will it be that classic, you're closing down our hospital, you know, single issue, single constituency, that's very emotive at that time. And I think this is a particularly difficult election in some respects, right? Because you've got a country of two halves. In the sense that you've got an economy that is one of the most successful economies in Europe, and the government deserve a lot of credit for that in terms of the turnaround. I mean, you know, I think the numbers are about 40 billion of extra spending available to the government now than even the time I would have been in the Department of Finance, which is a swing of 50% of extra funding. It's this debate that we're going to then have about how do we spend and cope with that success. And I think that will probably be where perhaps the parties move into different places. And going back to the housing targets earlier, I think in some ways there is a need for realistic checks on what the challenges are for us all. And so we can all see
how that success is being perceived, because by some, they are stuck in the attic of the parents' house and can't move out and their lives are stalled. For some, they find that the inflation that has come with aspects of that success means they can't pay for groceries. For others, they're high on the hog.
Absolutely. And what I was going to say as well is that I think for me, what I'll be watching in the independents is to what extent is there a coalition of independents around an issue that's very strong to me, which is regional balanced development. Because that wasn't what I meant, although I think you maybe thought I was going to say that on the country of two halves. There is, in fact, a country of two halves at the moment in terms of the success and how it's working outside of Dublin and inside Dublin. And we've seen in the last couple of weeks, particularly in the run-up to the budget, the underspend by the government, not in Dublin, where they probably need to be spending a bit more, and I'm sure David Rachmedwin would agree with me, but actually the even considerable greater underspend into infrastructure and the rest outside of the pale.
Which, to some extent, has it ever been thus? I mean, you go back to Shannon development way back in the year. We have always had that west of the Shannon issue yet to be resolved. The other issue in all this, returning to the politics, is how Sinn Féin managed to reverse the momentum they're currently facing. And it's going to be a fair challenge if you look at the front of today's Sunday Independent, where there's further detail emerging in relation to the complaint made against Brian Stanley, former chair of the PAC, and then the complaint made by Brian Stanley. So we'll get to some of that after this break. So that front page of the Sunday Independent: woman in Stanley complains Sinn Féin is protecting itself. Complainant tells of trauma over her hotel stay with TD. Regret over embarrassing text, and embarrassing is in inverted commas. Looking for €60,000. Before we get to that, Kevin Doyle has an update to bring us on Colin Farrell's pace.
Oh yeah, well no, there's a great app for the marathon. So I've been tracking all my friends who are doing the marathon, and I decided to track Colin Farrell, who's not my friend, but I just stuck it in anyway.
What might be after you get this announcement?
He's just crossed the 20k mark in 1 hour, 56 minutes and 20 seconds. And anyone who wants to see Colin Farrell, if you're at the finish line in Merrion Square, he's due to come in around 12:53 if he keeps the current pace.
Brilliant. Well, I'm glad that we were able to provide that public service, and congratulations to Colin. Exactly. Now, to the front of the Sunday Independent, details now emerging of some of what was in that complaint against Brian Stanley and some of what was in the complaint that he made in response to that complainant. What do we know?
Yeah, I suppose we can break this down. There are the undisputed facts that the two people involved in this, the woman and Brian Stanley, the facts that they agree on. And then there is the bit where their stories go in on different paths. So the undisputed facts is that she came up to Leinster House. He, for whatever reason, brought her car in and parked it in Leinster House. So TDs have free parking in Leinster House. He drove her car in and parked it inside the domain in Leinster House. They went in and had dinner and wine in the restaurant. They then went and had a couple of drinks in a pub, and at that point Leinster House was locked up and the car was left there, so they end up in a hotel room. He would have had a hotel room staying up for Leinster House anyway. We don't get into what happened there, but she claims subsequently that she's traumatised by whatever happened in the hotel room.
And it is worth saying that at no point in any of this is there any suggestion of any criminality made by anybody.
Absolutely not. She seems the next day to be very angry at him, and sends him a text message, basically, which she admits that he has the text messages and handed them over to the inquiry, that she wanted €60,000. Now, her explanation for that, and it was to be left in 6 envelopes at her house, and "I never want to hear from you again" was the finish of that. She admits that she did send those texts. She said it was out of anger. She said she wanted him to feel fearful, that she felt awful and she wanted him to feel awful, basically. So Sinn Féin found gross misconduct on the part of Stanley. And obviously, we know he resigned. It became public. And Sinn Féin, out of the quote at the time was an abundance of caution, went to the Gardaí with the story. I still can't for the life of me fathom why they decided to investigate it themselves in the first instance and not just bring all of this to the Gardaí at the time. But that is what we know. And the woman has spoken to Maeve Sheehan and kind of outlined some of why she says she sent that text message and what's played out from there. Brian Stanley, it's worth saying, through his solicitor, gave a statement reiterating a lot of what he said at the time, which is basically that he feels like this was
he's the victim here
is basically how he sees it, and that he was set up, and that basically there are people in the party who don't want him to run in the general election.
Now, setting aside the whatever occurred between this woman and Brian Stanley and the various different accusations made on both parts, the politics of this, Sinn Féin has had a number of difficult body blows in terms of its political positioning coming into this election. I assume one of the difficulties with this is it is now not really something that the party can get its hands around. It is, to some extent, associated with them, but out of their control.
Yeah, and it's all out in, well, not all out in the public, but there's a lot out in the public now. And you're right, the parties to this, the woman today is now critical of Sinn Féin. Brian Stanley is critical of Sinn Féin. So the party investigated this case, and now both parties who were involved in it are blaming Sinn Féin. She says that Sinn Féin is protecting itself now with the way that it handled it, by the way that it handed the case over to the Gardaí without even telling her or giving her a say in that. And Brian Stanley obviously has used phrases like kangaroo court, which is very charged when you're talking about a party like Sinn Féin. That's not an accident. Brian Stanley is a longtime Republican and a longtime member of Sinn Féin. So he knows the type of damage that inflicts when you bring that kind of language into it. So it's very hard for the party to do anything about this now. They can really only let it watch it play out.
And what does that mean then in terms of an election? Does that mean that they will be hoping that it lasts until the new year and the November 29th turns out to be a fugazi? Or is there anything that can be done short term to change the party's fortunes?
Well, I think the challenge here is that when we go forward, Micheál Martin and Simon Harris are going to be going, make me Taoiseach, I can be the best Taoiseach, I need my party to be the biggest. And if you go back to the last election, it was all around Mary Lou, and a narrative became around Mary Lou could be the first female Taoiseach. Right now, Mary Lou is in a tricky spot, because if she comes in and sits here, Anton, the first question you're going to start asking is about this. It's not going to be about the government failings on housing and what would you do, or on health. And look, over the course of a 3 week or 4 week campaign, obviously the policies will come to the surface and that will become what it is. And campaigns have lives of their own, so you don't know what controversies might come up for other parties. But the problem is, it's a very bad starting point. If you want to call the election race a marathon, you know, they haven't, they really haven't done any training. They have an Achilles heel injury, that they've all sorts of problems.
Well, John Moran is proof that it is possible to not train and just go out and do a 10K. So extrapolating from that, maybe that'll all work out well. Kevin, thank you very much for that. Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at Independent Newspapers. Likewise, thank you to John Moran, Mayor of Limerick, and Ursula Savage, political commentator.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.